At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, there's nothing quite like the drama of a last-minute winner, is there? You'd think as Manchester City fans we'd be used to it by now, but they do still catch you unawares when they come along, and there's no better way to take all 3 points. You could see that in the celebrations in the away dugout last Saturday evening. On today's Blue Moon podcast, we'll take a look back over that ding-dong battle at Newcastle, where the two teams decided to play out their own Goal of the Month competition in real time. We'll be focusing on the impact of Kevin De Bruyne's cameo and the quality of touch and finish from youngster Oscar Bob. That doesn't mean we'll be ignoring the other talking points as well. With no game to preview, there's time to get stuck into some other stuff around City too. The Premier League's chief executive, Richard Masters, has appeared before the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee.
I can't give any details on Man City beyond saying that a date has been set.
Not much there, but we know the case is progressing. And the former City manager, Sven-Göran Eriksson, has revealed that he's been diagnosed with terminal cancer. We make no apologies for setting aside a good chunk of time to revisit our interview with him in 2011 and to discuss his season in charge of the club. All that on the way. I'm David Mooney, and to help me digest everything this week, I'm joined by, from statcity.co.uk, Adam Carter.
Hello.
And the BBC's football correspondent, John Murray.
Hello.
Hello. John, good to have you back. Adam, I thought of you this week as City were banging in quality goal after quality goal. Me and you, we like to talk about some of the less good. So I look at the way around and just ask you, what's the shittest goal you've
So there's a fair few to go at, but I think I'll go fairly recent. You can have Grealish's first City goal, where it's just hit his thigh and gone in against Norwich. Or you can have Di Michaelis against Fulham, where he's just stood at the back post and it's almost just hit him and gone in to make it 5-0.
Was that the one he celebrated before it had gone in, though?
Yes, exactly. Because, he just kind of hooked his leg behind it.
Because that makes it iconic. I can never remember if it was that one or the West Brom one, but they're both similar, where he scuffed it over the line.
Yeah. And then another one that immediately came to mind, but it was far too important to be considered rubbish, was Aguero's goal against Burnley in the 2019 run-in, which came after an almighty goal-mouth scramble, which was so scrappy.
But it barely went in, yeah.
It barely went in, but it was too important to be able to actually put that on the list. But I've had to go for Di Michaelis if I'm pushed.
Yeah, my favourites from Guardiola's first season, it is Aguero at Burnley. There's an almighty scramble in the box, but two Burnley players kick each other and go flying. Touré basically grabs the ball and falls on top of it, claiming a penalty. Fernandinho kicks the ball into Sane. It almost overruns it at the back post. And then they scuff it across and it just hits Aguero and goes in. Our mate John Smith asked Guardiola in the press conference afterwards about the quality of the goals. And Guardiola just goes, beautiful goals. Beautiful goals. John, is there any good, any, we've seen good City goals this week. Any bad ones you can remember?
I'll tell you the ones that always really irk me are, as a commentator, are the goals that are important goals that aren't good goals.
Yeah.
But, you know, or if they're not clear, or if it's a big deflection, or, you know, the ones you were describing, you know, when it's a goal mouse scramble, it hits two or three people and then rolls over the line. You're not sure who scored it. You know, it might be an own goal, might not. And of course, if it's an important goal, if it's a cup final winning goal, then you want to be able to describe it in the way that you would want to. So, you know, I've had a few of those over the years, but also I've had plenty of ones where the one that wins it is actually a very, very good goal as well. So,
yeah.
Swings and roundabouts.
Yeah. We're going to get into all of that now. 2024 is upon us, which means a packed schedule of FA Cup, AFCON, and of course, Premier League action. Beat the January Blues and watch every game with the atmosphere it deserves down at your local Green King Sports Pub. Don't settle for a dodgy stream. If it's on the telly, it's on at your local Green King across their huge HD screens. If you download the Green King Sports app, you also receive 10% off every single drink whenever there's a game on. Their venues offer a range of low and no alcohol options, so dry January doesn't mean you have to settle for a worse sports watching experience. John, let's start then with City at Newcastle. We'd said five wonderful goals. What was it like to commentate on? I know you were doing the commentary. What was it like to be there?
Yeah, super game. Pat Nevin was with me, and even by half time, Pat was saying that he thought it was possibly the best game that he's seen this season. And certainly, I think the first half was right up there. I think the second half didn't quite hit the heights, but it was still, you know, an excellent half of football. And I thought for that spell in the first half was probably 20 minutes or so, maybe a little bit more than that. I thought the City performance was right up there with the Real Madrid performance last season. I thought they were absolutely outstanding, and how they, you know, if they'd scored the second goal in that spell, I don't think there would have been any coming back for that for Newcastle.
Yeah, we'd said five wonderful goals, Adam. How did you feel watching it? Because obviously you concede a great goal and you're going, well, okay, I'm annoyed about that, but it was still a good goal.
Yeah, to put a bit of context to it, so obviously Edison goes off in the first 8 minutes or so. We then go 1-0 up, and I overconfidently tweeted, I put, no Edison, no Stones, no De Bruyne, no Haaland, like no problem, 1-0. Because I just thought, what a tough task to go to St. James's Park without arguably our best player in each position, and to go 1-0 up. So I got overly confident. Then, as such games against Newcastle can be, where they turn into a basketball game, we get hit with two absolute pearlers at the other end, where we just decided we didn't want to defend for that period of time. And then it was a case of, here we go again. It's Everton. It's the Everton first half again. It's the Spurs game. It's the Palace game. You know, so where we were playing okay, but not getting our just rewards for it. So in the moment, I was, here we go again. But then, knowing that we'd created chances, we were continuing to create chances, and knowing that we did have De Bruyne on the bench, I was less stressed as I was in those other games that I've just alluded to.
Yeah. John, when you watch it kind of become that basketball game towards the end of the first half, I mean, for the neutrals like yourself, it's wonderful. For me and Adam, we start having kittens that City aren't controlling it. So what was it like towards as half-time was coming? It sounded like the stadium was up as well, and that there was a real feeling that Newcastle were taking the game to City.
I think at the moment there aren't too many better places to watch a match like that than St. James's Park. It's a great place to be at the moment. You know, as football grounds happen to be when teams are going through the type of times that Newcastle fans are enjoying now, and it's one of the most positive places that you go to. You know, so many football grounds there will be moaning and groaning. And I think that there's a tiny element of that creeping in with Newcastle, a tiny element. You know, I think possibly those who are beginning to get impatient for the successes. You know, there is that delicious looking forward to when it will arrive, which it surely will for Newcastle. But you know, that can't go on forever. And you will remember those times very well.
Been there, done that. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. But you know, in the main, the positivity at Newcastle is really infectious when you go there at the moment. And, you know, there's very, very little criticism for Eddie Howe. You know, the crowd in the main are hugely behind him, even though they've now lost, what is it, four in a row, Newcastle, in the Premier League. And they've lost 10 Premier League matches this season.
Crazy.
Yeah. And Adam, I mean, you think of kind of City's record as well. It, like previously, before this season, being behind at half-time away from home was a death knell for City. They didn't come back. And it's all they're doing this season. Pretty much every away game, they're behind at half-time. They go on and win it. And kind of combine that into Newcastle's recent form, you're kind of thinking, well, obviously this one's going to be the one where it doesn't happen, because Newcastle are desperate for a win. City are still making things difficult for themselves by trailing at halftime away from home. And they just got on with it and did it.
Yeah, that was definitely the case. My thought process at halftime, I was like, here we go again. The stat used to scroll back to the early 90s in terms of going behind at halftime. Now we've done it three in a row, certainly away from home in the Premier League. So it shows that we've turned that corner now. I'm declaring it securely turned. So when that comes back to bite me next week, or when we play Tottenham, you can replay that clip.
But that's in the FA Cup, you see.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll let that one slide. So yeah, when we're down away in the Premier League, don't worry, because we've turned that corner now. And I think we couldn't rely on that in the earlier part of the season when things were going tough. we kind of didn't have an answer, whereas now we've got a big ginger answer on the bench.
Yeah. let's talk about some of the individual players then. And it's a weird one, this, John, because when I was sitting down to think about this show before the game, I didn't expect to be leading on a youngster who's barely played for the club. But when you look at the impact that Oscar Bob made when he came on, and the fact that Guardiola turned to him in a situation where he needed the game to win it, he really trusts him, doesn't he?
Yeah, and that is the first and foremost indicator, isn't it, with Pep Guardiola? You know, if he trusts you, he plays you. You know, if he really backs you, you get in the team and you get on the field for Manchester City, as has been the case with Rico Lewis, hasn't it, regardless of the age. So, you know, as you will have heard and as I have, you know, really talk up players. But, you know, I've heard that with Foden. I've heard the same sort of language used for Rico Lewis. And now you hear the same sort of language used for Oscar Bob. So, you know, if he stays fit and healthy, it looks as though there is a great career ahead of him.
Yeah, tell me your reaction when he basically sidestepped Dubravka. What was it like in the ground and on commentary? Because that moment, I tell you, that moment when I was watching on TV, I was screaming, "Go down, go down! You've been fouled, go down!" And he didn't. He stayed on his feet, took it round him, popped it into the net. It was a wonderful goal.
Yeah, just the speed of footwork, really. I mean, it was something else. And I mean, Newcastle, you talk about the late goals with Manchester City. With Newcastle, they've been dealt so many blows this season, late goals against them or decisions against them, like the Paris Saint-Germain penalty in France when that match finished 1-1. The Carabao Cup tie against Chelsea when they were 1-0 up in the second minute of added time and end up going out of the competition on penalties. You know, late goals, AC Milan as well in their matches, you know, in the home sections there was a general feeling of here we go again, really.
yeah. Adam, when you were watching it, how did you react? Because I assume you weren't there, so I assume you fell off your sofa like I did.
Yeah, exactly. I was just, because of the way the game had gone, and because I know we'll speak about De Bruyne in a bit, he'd got his equaliser. I was just almost right. Tough game with all those players missing, with all the circumstances that we've just talked about. Take a point. And Newcastle almost seemed happy with that approach as well. They really laid off us in the second half. So I was like, right, everyone's accepted today and we're going to have to find our points elsewhere. And then that just illumined, just the whole place just lit up after that, because I was buzzing just to get back in the game. So when a youngster like Oscar Bob is to being that composed, in that I wasn't as composed, and I'm sat eating my fried chicken in my living room. So that's how, you know, that's, and the age, and you know, I'm extremely biased around academy products. And as soon as someone hits the academy, I want them in the first team scoring match winning goals. So that's just everything for me in terms of a young lad who's worked his way up, knows the City system and just slotted in perfectly. And he's almost a first teamer now without even having to really establish himself. There's no better way to establish yourself than a last minute winner in the Premier League to keep us in touch with Liverpool, is there?
Yeah, I was going to say, in terms of, like John mentioned, Rico Lewis, and he's almost taken on that mould of last season where he isn't, I don't know if you consider him a first team player yet, given his age and how involved he's been so far. But at the same time, he's not a youngster, is he? He's not someone you'd chuck in a few minutes to get experience now.
Exactly. Well, he's changed the game against Sheffield United, I think, when he assisted or pre-assisted Foden's ball across for Alvarez. He's now got this on his CV. So you're looking at him on the bench now to change games rather than always just there to get experience and to fill seats on the bench if we're away at a European side where the group's done and things like that. He's not that category anymore. He's the next one along. You wouldn't be fuming if he started, and you wouldn't be surprised if he's not been selected in the next few games. But he's certainly already achieved that status of match changer rather than just experience getter.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how involved he is going forward, I guess, John, because when you think of Lewis last season, he came in around Christmas. Things weren't really working for City at the time, and he was one of the players that helped develop the role for John Stones later in the season. And as the big games came later on, he was less and less involved. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like that was a punishment. It wasn't unmerited. He was very much a part of the squad last season, and you can see this season he's now very involved in it all as well. And you think what that could mean for Bob? He might not be involved that much towards the end of this season, but by the time next season comes along, he's a first-team player. Does that make sense?
Yeah, entirely it does, yeah. And, you know, he's a genuine option now, isn't he? And what is that? I think that's three starts, isn't it, now that he's made this season. And I think what it means is that when we get into the later months of this season, if injuries do come again, you know, he is an option that will slot right in there, you would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Let's talk about Kevin De Bruyne, John, because are you surprised that he's not looked anywhere near rusty given the amount of time he's had off? He's come on and he's slotted straight back in. And as City fans, we always talk about how he needs three or four games to get back into the swing of things. And he's had 20 minutes and he's just running the show.
But they had to get it right with him this time, didn't they? Because of what happened with the injury and the way that developed at the end of last season. And, you know, they took a gamble, didn't they? And that gamble really resulted in him being out of the picture for the 5 months that he has been. So, you know, I think he wasn't going to be back on the field until they were absolutely 100% confident that he was going to be right. And that's what they've done. And it wasn't a surprise, really, when you think about it, that he didn't start the match on Saturday. And I think the way the match went as well, I think that backed up the, you know, not just the fact that he came on and did what he did. I mean, in terms of the pace of the match in the first half, you know, it looked like an entirely sensible option to bring him on when he did for the amount of time that he did.
Yeah, what was it like watching that goal when he the way he manoeuvred his body around the ball to be able to pass it into the bottom corner was just expertly done.
Yeah, listen, I was saying on Saturday during the commentary, I'll tell you who it reminded me of. It actually reminded me of a guy who very often sits next to me for commentaries, Chris Waddle. It just had that sort of, because he's a little bit bigger, isn't he? And I think it's possibly the hair as well makes him look a little bulkier.
Yeah.
You know, just the way that his body went and the way that he tucked it away, it just really brought back a bit of Chris Waddle for me.
Yeah, I think it's his posture. I think he's got terrible posture, and it looks like he's a bit of a dad in the middle of the game instead of this fine athlete. And then when you actually watch him, he is just actually a fine athlete with bad posture. Yeah. It's not anything else. Yeah. Adam, Jurgen Klopp said recently that the rest of the league was shaking at his return. Yeah. I was a little bit sceptical because I kind of felt, as you know, I think most people did, that De Bruyne would need some time to settle back into it. But when he comes on and assists and scores and changes the game in the way that he did, the rest of the league is probably right to be shaking, isn't it?
Yeah, just want to echo John's comments there around. I think they've handled the rusty stage has actually been off the pitch because he's been ready for a few weeks now, but actually hasn't played. Whereas back in the day, we would have just rushed him straight back and then he has to find his feet on the pitch. So I think that's absolutely correct in why he's not been rusty. Then in terms of Klopp's comments around everyone shaking, I think Newcastle were quite satisfied with the way the game was going, obviously 2-1 up, but also letting us play out in front of them because we didn't have any perceived threat or any chances we were creating, we weren't taking. I think they were quite happy with that. Then De Bruyne comes on, their mindset almost, they just, that midfield just almost just shrank. The Newcastle midfield just shrank and just were locked in position. And Rodri and De Bruyne were able to play around that. And it's only in the modern game does De Bruyne is that shot on for De Bruyne for him to score. No one else takes that shot in the current game. And that's what he gives you. That he's the difference between a game petering out to a 2-1 defeat or at best a 2-2 draw into 3 points rather than one. And that, you know, he's just so, so special. And this highlights where we've missed him because there's been previous games I've alluded to, Tottenham, Palace, you know, games we've lost in last minutes, Arsenal's. Whereas if you've got De Bruyne on the pitch, is he that difference that takes us from those draws into wins? And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, the difference maker. I'm going to humble brag time now because I've... So through doing Let Me Talk and the other City podcast, I get on fairly well with Nader Manua, and he's asked me a few times to play in their five-a-side games. And there's always a few ex-pros floating around and involved. And one of them said to me the other night, you're the goalkeeper, you can see everything. Like talk to us, you can see everything in front of you. And I realized in the middle of that, not only was I out of breath from having to do the actual exercise, but at the same time I couldn't verbalize what it was that I wanted to, that I could see in front of me. In like, I didn't have the speed of thought to be able to express what I could see to translate to them. And I don't know if you saw, John, this week, Kevin De Bruyne gave an interview in Flemish after the game where he basically talked through his thought process of scoring that goal and the things he was thinking about in that split second. I don't understand how anybody's got the brain power to compute it, because he's watching like where Julian Alvarez has run, where the defenders are going, that Fabian Scher has got more of the goal to cover than he would like, so his legs are probably slightly more open than normal. So he thinks, maybe I can slide it through there and leave it out of reach of the goalkeeper. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't understand how you can process this so quickly.
I often marvel at the speed of thought that the very best players have when you see them, whether it's Messi or whether it's Mbappe or whether it's Kevin De Bruyne or, you know, Bernardo Silva as well, you know, in the way that he took that ball away for his goal on Saturday, you know, the speed of thought and the execution that goes into that. But I think Pep Guardiola said after the match on Saturday, didn't he, about Kevin De Bruyne, he said something along the lines of he has more space and freedom than anyone else. And you can see it, can't you? He just instinctively is able to find those places. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing Guardiola said, John, after the game was that the performance was fine without De Bruyne, but then when he comes on, he adds those big moments. And I guess that's the difference. I mean, City could have won the game without bringing him on, possibly, but it's almost like bringing him on makes it that little bit more certain.
The thing about City this season, obviously, they've played to this point virtually without him, with him only making the appearances that he has. But I think as well, you know, there have been bumps, haven't there? There have been hiccups along the way this season. But I think when you consider who's not been there, as you were mentioning earlier, you know, John Stones has played so little football this season. De Bruyne, what is it now, 9 matches, I think, that Haaland's missed, the last 9 matches in all competitions. And you know, I feel watching them that they still miss Gundogan. You know, I think he's that player they don't have anymore. Yet, where are they? They're 2 points off the lead, and I think that's the concern for the other clubs in Liverpool.
Yeah, sorry about this, John, but I'm going to ask you to pick your best finish now from the City ones: Bernardo, De Bruyne, or Bob. Which are you going for?
I'm going to go for. It's got to be Bob. I think it's got to be Bob.
Yeah, the silky footwork. Adam, which did you go for?
I'm going for Bernardo. Just the instinct, whipped cross in, and to put us 1-0 up in tricky situations. I know Bob wins us a game in tricky situations. You've got that as well, but Bernardo for me.
Yeah. A couple of other things from the game to tidy up. First off, John, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on this. The City have had 2 freak injuries recently to defenders in 3 big games. Because of basically the late offside flag. I'm not really sure there's any other way you can do it in the VAR era. You kind of have to let it play out if it's a tight one. What's your thoughts on it all?
Unlucky for Manchester City that it's happened twice in the space of 3 games. But, you know, everyone's said it for so long, haven't they, that it is an inevitability when you officiate in this way. And you're right. I don't think there's any other way that you can do it. You have to see how things play out unless it's absolutely, you know, so clear. I'm not sure how you would get around it, in all honesty, because I think you have to use the system in the way that it is currently being used.
Yeah, Adam, it's still frustrating. Did you see the hole in Edison's leg?
I thought it was photoshopped. It was that clean a cut. It doesn't make it any less frustrating. But it's weird. I totally agree with the delayed flag, even though it's leading to these situations because there's no way around it. And I tweeted saying 2 injuries to 2 delayed flags. And it looked as if I was complaining about the system, but I get it's the system. So it's just it doesn't make it any less frustrating, and it doesn't make the players any less injured because it happened when the game wasn't in play anymore. So it's frustrating. But that cut to Edison's leg was graphic.
Yeah, it's an X-rated image, that one. Adam, Kyle Walker's been criticised this season. He came under flak for both goals again. Do you agree with it? I guess for the second one, he could get out there a bit quicker. But ultimately, it feels like there's more fundamental flaws in the way City were playing than Kyle Walker didn't close his man down.
Yeah, that ball seemed to be on a lot, that ball behind. And we were getting caught by it a lot. Obviously, I mentioned there were some offside calls as well that came on the back of them. So that ball was on a lot. And it was obviously by design because we didn't do anything about it after the third or fourth way they were catching us. With But also, this is really ridiculous for me to criticise any professional athlete as I'm sat here in my bedroom recording a podcast talking about it. But it just looked as if it was a choice not to go and close the man down. I think, A, Walker thought he had the pace on both of them if he needed it, but it never really came to that because they stood off him and still had enough room to shoot. So it did look like a choice. It didn't look like he got caught in two minds. There was an overlapping run that maybe gave him a little element of thought, but we're talking about this speed of thought, and to be at the elite level, you need to be able to make the right decisions in that split second. Now, obviously, there's off-the-pitch issues with Walker, which we won't go into, but I thought that might be playing on his mind a bit, and it was just some weird defending for someone who we've been able to rely on so heavily when there's a counter-attack against us. So, yeah, it just looked like a choice to me, which is absolutely I know that my first ABC analysis, and there'll be more depth to it, but on first viewing, I was like, get out. You go on Twitter, everyone's saying, why has he not closed him down? And because we're used to him doing that, so that's why it looked so weird, because he'd just been beaten by the exact same goal in the space of 5 minutes. And I think that compounds it as well in terms of how bad a performance was. When it's all in one, microscopic moment, then it seems worse than it actually was, because he provided the assist, and Pep was more than gushing in his praise of him after the game in terms of the cuddles and hugs at the celebration. So he obviously didn't have a public problem with it anyway.
They have been vulnerable, haven't they, in this way? And that's not just my, unlike you, I don't see all of the games all of the time, but it's my feeling that they have been, and they are vulnerable. They've conceded goals. What, I think it's two clean sheets away from home this season. So they have leaked goals and that is not unusual for them to concede goals in that way. I think with Kyle Walker as well, and there've been the sort of non-football related headlines over the course of the last week. But I think he's shown in the past that when there's been noise off the field, I think he said it, that he finds that actually playing the game, he's one of those people, I think, who's able to switch off of that and switch on to what he's doing when it comes to the job as a football player.
Yeah. The other player that I wanted to bring up, John, just to finish, was Rodri, because he seemed to control absolutely everything City did. What was it from the TV? It's quite hard to get a view of his overall performance in the ground. What was it like?
He looks like an absolute colossus. When you see him in up against, I think I was looking at it next to Miley, and who's obviously a 17-year-old, so he's effectively a boy, but he is quite literally head and shoulders above some of his opponents, and he's just his stature, the way he carries himself, everyone knows how important he is.
Yeah. What is there a sense, Adam, that he might need to calm his temper a little bit?
Yeah.
Because sent off against Nottingham Forest in unusual circumstances earlier in the season, in a way that you don't expect from him. Perhaps a little bit lucky in against Newcastle, given that already on a yellow, he went steaming into Bruno in the box.
Yeah, I'm constantly on pins when we see this red-headed temperament that he's got. But annoyingly, he's usually right in the decisions that are going against him. He can be a good master of the dark arts as well. He's not innocent by any stretch of the imagination. But every time he loses his head, I'm thinking, learn your lesson from the Forest game. You're so important to us. But I guess in the heat of the battle, he's not going to think back, oh yeah, I'm going to get sent off if I lose my head here. He's just going to lose his head. But I'm always on... When anyone ever leaves something on him and he reacts, I'm like, no, please don't. But that's easy for me to say. And he's just so important to us, and that's highlighted by the stats that he's not lost in 50 games, and we lost all the four that he didn't play this season, and it's just that speaks for itself. So, but I'd love someone to, just as soon as that issue arises, literally runs in there, arm around the shoulder, and turns him around and goes the other way, because without that, we are always, he's always on the edge, but I think the best players are, and he obviously needs to play with that little bit of fire just to excel as he does.
His strength, David, his strength is actually an Achilles heel for Manchester City now, because of the fact that they've lost the games when he's missing.
Yeah.
I could see a scenario whereby, for whatever reason, when the biggest games come around, if he's not available, I could see that being a real issue.
Yeah, it's a psychological thing. It becomes a psychological thing now as well, because the stats back it up. So then, it becomes factual then, doesn't it? And it that will be a worry in the business end, certainly.
Yeah. What I would say, Adam, just to calm those nerves, is there's been a couple of times he's been on a yellow this season and looked on the edge and has kept it all under control. So, he can do it.
I'll pick you up on that one when it does spill over next time. But yeah, I love these therapy sessions that you provide for me.
Good.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsafe the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/ Blue Moon Podcast.
Well, last week, the former City manager Sven-Göran Eriksson revealed that he's been diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer and he's got about a year left to live. With the winter break leaving City without a game this weekend, we've decided to use the extra time in this week's show to reminisce about the season that Sven had at Eastlands. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Chris Higginbottom, Dom Farrell and Richard Burns. But first, we're going to hear some of the interview I did with Sven back in January 2011. He starts here by remembering the run-up to the first Manchester derby of that 2007-08 campaign.
I wish at that time that we had more times to prepare things and that we didn't, well, it was more or less every day it came a new player. But anyhow, the players were very clever and very good football players. So we started the season very well, and better than I thought we should have, and better than anyone thought, I guess. You could feel it the whole week before that this is something special. And I remember when I signed for City, one of the supporters came to me and said, "Sven, don't talk about Europe or the league or whatever it is. Just beat Manchester United twice, and that's it," he said. "That's the most important." It's important, of course it's important, but the most important, of course, is the final result for the club. You could feel the derby, and if you compare it with Lisbon or Rome or where I've been before, it's great. Probably it's the biggest derby I've been involved in.
I think it's pretty much agreed that after Christmas the form wasn't quite as good, but there was one game that really stands out for City fans, and that's the second derby of the season at Old Trafford. How were you feeling about that before the game?
Well, it was a special game because it was Memorial Day for the tragic air accident for Manchester United. So in that way, it was very, very special. And I will always remember in all my life the minutes before the kickoff when it was 1 minute silence. And I remember during all the week, some of the people from City, they were nervous that City fans would boo them or something like that. And I think it was a great 1 minute of civilization and education or whatever you say. You couldn't hear anything at the stadium for the whole minute, and that's one of these moments you're getting very, very proud of the club you work for and the fans you were working for. Very, very proud. It was great.
What do you remember of the game itself?
Well, I think we were not lucky. We were very good. We deserved to win that game. If you talk about the first game at home, we played okay, we played good, we won. But the second game, I think we were brilliant and we deserved to beat United at that time. At home, we played good, but not as good as we did away. Away was a very, very good football game.
And what do you think went wrong then towards the end of the season for you at City?
Well, we dropped a little bit in form, that's for sure. Or maybe it's more normal. I think Christmas time we were second in the league at a certain point for rather a long time, if I don't remember badly. I think we were very good. I don't think we were as good as we could keep a second place for the rest of the season. That was one reason. Another reason, at the end of the season, it became too many rumors about my future in the club, and not my relationship, but Texan's relationship with me was totally broken down. He never talked to me. He didn't want to talk to me the last couple of months, and of course players knew that, and the whole ambient became, from being great, it became not bad, but it became, well, I think everyone was at that time a little bit disappointed of what was happening, not on the pitch, but off the pitch.
Well, I was going to say, what was it like managing the team, knowing that the chairman intended to sack you at the end of the season? That must have been very difficult for you.
Well, you have to try to do the best you can, but it wouldn't have been a problem if only I knew about it, or I didn't know about it, but I was rather sure that would happen. But as soon as it comes out to other people in the club and the players and the staff, and at the end the fans knew it as well, or they suspected it, then it becomes very difficult. And I think for everyone, and I think it's very, very normal that it shouldn't have happened, that came out. I think the Thai people at that time with Dr. Texan, he could have sacked me at the end of the season, but he should never have letting us suspect it that would happen. That was his great mistake. So I take the blame for the last games of the season, but I think he should take equal blame of it, because as a football director, you can't act like that.
Hear the full interview on our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
So that was Sven-Göran Eriksson speaking to me back in 2011. I'm now joined by Chris Higginbottom.
Hello there.
Dom Farrell.
Hello.
And Richard Burns.
Hello.
And we're going to take a few minutes now to look back over that 2007-08 season that Sven was in charge of. Dom, we were listening to him there, and it's just brought back a whole load of memories from that season. And I can't believe it's so long ago that we actually spoke to him on the podcast as well. But before we get into that season itself, we should actually start with what it was like before he arrived. So what do you remember of where City were before Sven joined? Because like Stuart Pearce had been sacked, the takeover wasn't really happening until late in that summer. The fans just needed a bit of optimism, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it was unspeakably bleak, wasn't it, really? It was, of course, the infamous season where City just decided to forgo scoring goals at home. Last home goals in the league on January the 1st in that season. 10 home overall. And in a sort of the more things change, the more things stay the same way, I remember quite vividly the day that the Shinawatra takeover looked like it was being confirmed was the same day that it came out that Joey Barton had battered Usman Darbo in training and that had all blown up. I saw that on my phone when I was out in Manchester. So it's like even then you were checking your phone and realised Joey Barton had been a bell end. So,
whatever happened to him, by the way?
we all still are. I mean, I do remember, and it's an interesting thing about the taxing takeover. And I think, obviously, there's been lots and lots of talk about the various issues that come along with City's current ownership. But I think one of the reasons there was a bit of a lightness of touch around the Abu Dhabi takeover when it happened is that Taksin was, by all accounts, like a lunatic on the run, who Amnesty International were like, this guy's a big wronger, and he's like, you know, disappeared a lot of drug dealers or whatever. Yeah, that was mad. So I remember thinking at that time, it's like, so this crackpot with lots of very well frozen assets, as it turned out, was going to buy the club, and the best player, although that does say an awful lot about the rest of the players in that team, has just basically been thrown out for putting a teammate in hospital. It's like, this is terrible. And then along came Sven, and it's just like, you get in that interview that you had with young David Mooney there. That,
yeah, I sound so young in that, don't I?
there's just such a lightness, and he always had like a natural levity. And I like, cause obviously, it wasn't that long after he was England manager. And
it's like a year, wasn't it? 1 year.
Yeah, it was his next job after, wasn't it? Mm. Yeah, it was a year. But like, and when he came into England, it was like, you know, it was a big sort of thing of England having an overseas manager. And he sort of quickly sort of captured everyone's hearts then. I think it's as simple as it was just really nice to have a nice bloke in charge. And obviously, they signed some of those players that, you know, people like Ilana and Petrov are like still cult heroes. Stephen Ireland had his Superman underpants season, you know. So there was loads of other good things going on. But it just, everything about the club at that time felt so sort of just horrid.
Yeah. And it needed it, didn't it?
And then just Sven waltzes in his perfect suit, just being really polite to everyone. It was kind of really nice.
Yeah, Chris, when Dom's mentioned there the summer signings, you think back, it was a trolley dash around Europe for like in the space of 23 days. He signed Bianchi, Gelson Fernandez, Giovanni, Petrov, Chorluka, Alano, Garrido, and Bozhinov. And like all of a sudden, these players are arriving at City, and like we've got a little bit of momentum, and there's things happening. How were you feeling when all this was going on?
Absolutely brimming with excitement and anticipation. To be honest, it was as Dom's alluded to there. It was a bit of a sketchy time with Thaksin and all that entailed, and Eriksen just really was like a bit of a beacon in the middle of that. He was a class act, said everything right. His record, his club record was really, really good. I mean, England wasn't that bad, but you know, he was a classy manager, said all the right things very well. And to be honest, the players that he brought in just added to that excitement, really. They looked, I mean, when we won at West Ham 2-0 on the opening day, it was like there was a very, very different feeling to, it's like the antithesis of the prevailing feeling that the Stuart Pearce era kind of weighed you down with.
Yeah, it was diametrically opposed, wasn't it?
That's yeah, what it was, yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it was a glorious sunshine, one of the most beautiful kits we've ever had. I've still got that shirt, by the way, which I think somebody got a job lot of them from Vietnam or something. I bought one in the Trevor Arms while I was working there off. Well, I won't tell you who.
Yeah, so let's keep names out of it.
Cheers, Jimmy. But yeah, it was fantastic. And everyone was just cock-a-hoot, weren't it? It was like, we're going to win the league. This is amazing. Look at this team. Look at all these players. They've all been brought in. They're all gelling fantastically with each other and with the existing players. There's a lot of good academy players in the squad and the team. And it just felt like a new dawn. And in many ways, I guess, well, it was one. It was one of them.
You have a lot of people who, well, maybe a lot might be stretching it, but you still hear people talk about that West Ham away as like one of the great days out. And
yeah,
when you consider the days out that have followed, I think that speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah. Richard, when you think back to what Manchester was like as well, I remember seeing billboards all over the city with a close-up of Sven's face in black and white, and then in blue it just said underneath, "Old Blue Eyes is back." And it was just like the club were getting really on board with this injection of good feeling as well.
Yeah, God, I forgot about that. It was, I mean, they needed to, didn't they? For reasons that have already been discussed. Like, it was like a new dawn sort of barely covers it because of how bad it had been before. Like, to go from the absolute nadir, like that, looking back at the 10 goals at home season, to me, is almost like more of a reference point for how bad we've been in Premier League terms than relegation seasons, because it's like teams get relegated all the time. Not many teams go like nearly half a season without scoring a goal at home. So to go from that to having the takeover and an established manager who'd won things at club level, who, you know, there was an element of being, I don't know if exotic is the right word to use, but like that, bringing in an overseas manager, like City could attract somebody with this status. Mm. Like, the club had to harness that. That was it would have been terrible from a PR perspective not to try and harness it. There was a really good feeling.
I'd not thought about that as well, but like they'd had previous, like previously they'd had Keegan, so they'd had an England manager as City as their next job. But there's something different about Eriksen over Keegan, like moving on from England to City, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. I think maybe with Keegan, there was an element of, like, he'd failed, hadn't he, at international level. By his own admission, he hadn't been good enough to do that job. And he, I guess he'd had the sort of groundswell of support to get it at the time, and it hadn't worked out. So there was almost an element of, he could really have been at the end of his career, and he came to City and, I guess, proved that wasn't the case, and did really well for the vast majority of that time. Eriksen, by my recollection, didn't really feel like that. He'd come to a natural end as England manager. It hadn't quite gone as well as people would have liked, given the quality of players that he had available to him. But actually, you look back and the consistency of England reaching World Cup quarterfinals was something that then wasn't replicated until Southgate. So he was a high performer. Like, he came in having done a pretty reasonable job managing top level players. And
unlucky that, with then, some send-ins off as well in those England games, weren't they?
Yeah. And then I think you factor into that, like you mentioned, the sort of mad dash around Europe collecting players. You got the sense that we had a manager whose name played a big part in why we could attract players who had pretty decent reputations at the time and who caused all that excitement. Like, that was a really good thing to be able to harness as well.
Yeah, Dom, that press conference photo where he's surrounded by about eight of his new signings is a joy to behold.
It's brilliant. Vedran Korlukazer, he looks like I saw this that picture the other day. You know the vultures at the end of the Jungle Book. He looks like one of them, like his hair like over his eyes. He does look like one of the vulture beetles. I remember really vividly that. So that summer I had a summer job, given it was summer, at Piccadilly Station, like stacking the drinks trolleys for the first class trains, which was like, you'd go in, it was like early every morning, you finish at lunchtime. So like, there was kind of a thing of walking through town was when they handed out, they were still giving out free MENs then.
Yeah.
And like, there was a genuine thing of like getting off the bus, because obviously it's just about before Twitter, isn't it, this time, of getting the free newspaper and going, who's the City assigned today then? What is a Javier Garrido? You know? It was great. And yeah, there was a lot of United fans who worked in that warehouse actually, and I was still doing the job when the derby at the Etihad happened. The City of Manchester Stadium happened. So that was good too. Good times.
Favourite players from those early ones, Chris? Are there any that stood out as absolute City legends for you?
Well, I mean, the obvious one is Ilano, a player of real class, but also when he wanted to, he could put it about a bit. He was just a really, really good all-round footballer and a cracking right-back, as it turned out eventually. But I really liked Korluka. A lot of people slagged him off a bit. I think that was due to his weird... He had like a weird running style.
He only had one gear, didn't he?
Well, it looked like that. He ran in... He sort of had the running style of like Pingu or some strange plasticine animation. He kind of just flopped along, but he was quicker than he looked. And I thought he was a really good footballer. And I had an absolute torch for... Bojanov, I just thought he was class, and it just absolutely ruined me every time he got injured, because it was just evidently never really going to work for him. And I think if he'd have stayed injury free, I think he would have been an absolute world beater.
Yeah, I have to Richard chuck out a shout for Martin Petrov, because in terms of like actual wing play, I'd not seen a winger like Petrov at City before.
Yeah, well, that was. If you'd have asked me the same question you asked Chris, then other than saying, I mean, bizarrely, Chris stole literally every word that I wanted to say about Gianluca. the
pingu bit,
yeah. That was running through my mind too. I've always thought that.
Waddling through your mind, it was.
Well, looks like a waddle was actually running. This is the thing.
Petrov would have been mine. He was just exciting, wasn't he? And again, I suppose it goes... It, it works in contrast to what had come before as well, when nothing was exciting. Like, absolutely nothing about watching City before this time was exciting in the, you know, the time immediately preceding it. So to then be going watching someone who really beat a man and, like, was happy running at players, and he was, you know, the kind of player that is a bit of a cliche, I suppose, but a player like that gets fans off the seat. And if, like, we weren't in contention for winning the league, I know we were challenging around the top four for the first half of the season, but when you know that most of the time this isn't going to result in trophies, like, I think the excitement of going watching exciting players, and I guess flair players whose intention is just to attack, like, you invest a lot in that. And obviously you still do, like, it's still great to go and watch exciting players, but I guess now we watch so many more of them that it's a lot more normalized.
There's a bigger picture to it as well, isn't there? This was new.
Exactly, yeah. And it was, Petrov would be, I guess, still my standout favourite from that era.
He could dig out a cross from deep as well, couldn't he? Like a sort of Hagi-esque ability to put a whip on the ball from a place like so deep that you wouldn't expect him to get a decent cross into the box and still curl it across and be in swing into an incoming kind of forward run. I really liked his technique.
I tell you that, I mean, people will remember him delivering the ball for Benjani's goal at Old Trafford, but the one that I always think of as a typical Martin Petrov move is the Mpenza diving header against Newcastle, where he gets it on the halfway line. He just hits it down the line because he knows he's faster than the defender, gets round the outside, and it looks like he's gone too far with it, crosses it back, and Mpenza heads it in. And it's honestly incredible wing play. If you don't remember it, go back and watch it if you can. It's incredible. Dom, the other player I wanted to shout out in the early days of that season was Michael Johnson, because he'd come into the team under Stuart Pearce at the back end of the previous season, but it was only really under Sven that he started to excel.
Yeah, I saw, so obviously when the very sad news about Sven came out the other week, a lot of people were sharing that Michael Johnson goal against Derby, which, again, to go back to the previous points, was a league goal at home. That was like, remember those? And it's such a wonderful goal. And it's a passage of play that sums up what Johnson was so good at. Like, he was so elegant, such a graceful player, but there's an understated power about him too. I saw someone saying it's the most Kevin De Bruyne goal not scored by Kevin De Bruyne, which I think is a tremendous shout. Although maybe De Bruyne would have absolutely cased it rather than hitting it delicately with the outside of his foot like Johnson did. Yeah, he was absolutely delightful.
At the time, people were comparing it to Bell, weren't they, when he scored it?
Yeah, totally. And that's the other point of reference that you get with KDB nowadays, I guess. It was like, I think we said earlier, it's like there was the combination between these exciting new signings, but you had that youthful core of Richards, Anuha, Ireland, Johnson. Like, you know, the academy was bearing fruit, and it was real quality. It wasn't like, with the greatest respect, Willow Flood getting a game because there was no one else about. It was such a lovely blend of players. You also, I mean, I know City fans think of him as just being a gobshite nowadays, but you had Didi Herman at the base of that midfield as well, who looked for all the world like a terrible signing under Pearce. But him sort of at the base of that midfield with Johnson and Alano, Petrov and Ireland in front of him, just sort of knitting it all together. I remember Herman was brilliant in that Old Trafford derby. That first 11 was just a really, really good blend. And for that first half, two-thirds of the season, it was a pleasure. And Johnson, when he was fit, because obviously that was also the year when his fitness problems properly started. But when Johnson was fit, he was a delightful part of that.
I had a beer with Michael Johnson, actually. He's a lovely fella. Met him in a bar in Fallowfield, and I think this was on the sort of when he was out of the team and there were question marks about why he was out and people speculating. And he was just really, really open and honest. He's an Urmston lad as well, so that was kind of an in with me in terms of, like, you know, oh, hiya, mate. Good to see you. You're Michael Johnson, aren't you? And he was aware that he was and confirmed it. And, same neck of the woods. Really nice lad. Bought us a beer. Was genuinely warm and open and honest about the fact that he just said something. I'm paraphrasing because it was a long time ago. It was just basically head wasn't in the right place. Came to the decision that the right thing to do was to knock it on the head. Enjoyed it while he was you know, active and doing well, but it wasn't for him. And he was doing really well. I think he was something in the line of estate agents or something like that, but he seemed to be on his feet and really, really nice lad.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that. Richard, let's talk about the Derby double, because it was the first time we as fans had experienced that had experienced winning at Old Trafford as part of this. The first Derby was good. The second Derby was better. Even was that the one you were caught swearing on Sky?
David, what a thing to say. Yes, it was.
Yeah, it was. Yes, it fucking was.
I mean, the first one was, as I recall, somewhat fortuitous.
Yeah, they battered us for 90 minutes and we scored against the run of play.
Yeah, I think of all the Derby victories that we've pulled off over United, and even used to pull off even when we weren't the top dogs in Manchester, that one was the one that was like the most, how on earth have we done this? Even the goal was deflected, wasn't it? But the Old Trafford one, I was caught flipping the V's at the United fans on 82 minutes and 15 seconds. Not that I remember. The mobile reception is terrible in the Old Trafford away end. So I got out to a raft of text messages. I'm sure I've just seen you on TV. And then about a week later on Facebook, a United supporting school friend of mine who was on a gap year in Australia messaged me to say the first game I've been able to watch in 2 months was the Derby, and I'm on the other side of the world and your effing face comes up on my screen. I was like, this is absolutely perfect.
So the eighth minute then?
Eighty-second minute. So when we were 2-0.
Right. Also, I thought like within 10 minutes of this beautiful moment of Mancunian harmony and togetherness, you were like, yeah, fuck off.
No. Giving it the big one once we were in a commanding lead and it looked like we were going to hold on to it. The next time I saw that guy was his first game back from Australia was before a derby at Old Trafford. I saw him outside, said hello to him, asked him what he thought the game was going to be like, and he said, I can't call it a win, but it'll definitely be tight. And yes, he went on to win 6-1. So, that was great. But yeah, the Benjani derby was to pull off a double against them when I think Sven said it in that interview that you played at the start, like that's enough to cement a legacy as a manager or as a player, because we just hadn't done that in, was it 35 years or so?
I think it was 69 years since the previous one. So yeah.
Yeah. It was so long since we'd won at Old Trafford, so long since we'd
played without a sponsor.
Yeah, also true. So since we've done the double, so just to go there and fully deserve it, like that was the difference from the Etihad win. Like we were well worth that win, and obviously there's a lot to be said for the occasion and whether that affected United, but on the pitch City were the better team, and it was just magnificent. It was proper bragging rights. And I guess you look back at it now and those kind of things, again, they've become pretty normal, but at the time they just weren't, and we should never lose sight of that. It was huge.
Yeah. Chris, you mentioned the kits. They were playing kits for the anniversary, and it was, I don't know why, but I can't explain why. That makes it all the more special for me.
Well, yeah, it's just nice to see a kit like that, isn't it? It's like when we played in the Charity Shield with that special edition kit. No, but I mean, it just takes away the corporate element, and it's just easier on the eye, and aesthetically, it's just far more appealing. Similar that sash third kit where the Etihad sponsor is like really diddy under the badge is one of my favourite kits as well. But yeah, the whole thing was just absolutely perfect. Although immediately after the game, I was working two jobs at the time because we'd started when I was a gardener. Business was kind of in its infancy, and I had a second job at the Trevor Arms where I got that other kit from, actually. And immediately on the final whistle, there was a few Reds in there quite a few people in there who didn't normally drink in there, and there was a little bit of tension. City's win didn't go down massively well with quite a few people, and there was a huge riot in the vault. And yeah, I ended up doing Neo-style chair dodging as they hurtled through the air towards me. I'm just like leaning back with my arms going, whoa, like octopusing out of the way of the flying bits and bobs. But yeah, good fun day all around.
Yeah. Benjani's gold on. Talk me through your reaction when that went in.
That was incredible. So the first goal is brilliant because it's one of those. So I watched that at home with folks, and had like a few sort of mates round.
Vassell's trying. He's trying his best to miss that, isn't he?
I mean, hasn't Edwin van der Sar stopped a throw-in really on the first one? It's nowhere. So, but like because of that chaos of everyone around the box. So I find the best goal celebrations are the ones where it's like nearly in. And then, because so everyone's already out of their seat by the time it finally goes in, so that was bedlam round our house. But it was still like a bit of a novelty thing of like it's winning at Old Trafford, and that's great. It's never happened since 1974, but this is fun. By the way, the fan who said just beat United twice, was he insane? It's like like just never happened, did it? Like Sven, you just do this thing that hasn't happened for 3.5 decades. Crack on, that'll be fine. All you've got to do.
He was right though, wasn't he?
It was, but yeah, I mean, just strikes me as a mad thing to say. Anyway, the second goal was like, it just felt really surreal. And it's like, I remember thinking quickly after that win, thinking, oh God, they could actually win here. But still being scarred by the first derby I went to as a season ticket holder was the one where Niall Quinn scored twice for half time and United won 3-2. So you know it's like 2-0 is a dangerous scoreline and all that. But yeah, the Benjani one just felt properly like lightheaded, surreal. Like, is this really happening?
Yeah, here we go. The second half of the season, though, Richard, that game is the standout because aside from that, it all did turn quite sour towards the end. What do you put that down to? There was a lot of players injured. There was a lot of off the field turmoil. Was it just too much for everybody, do you think?
I think so. And I think, I mean, feel free to tell me if I'm talking absolute rubbish and letting sort of the latter half of the season cloud my memory of the first. I do think maybe there's a sense that the first half of the season was a bit of an overperformance as well. Like to go from, like even just in thinking, like to settle so many new players into a team and get immediate results out of them is a really, really difficult thing to do. And that was something obviously City did manage to achieve. But again, like to labour this point about what had gone before it, to go from a team that couldn't score goals and were, you know, on that basis, quite fortunate to stay in the division, to then being a team that are really knocking around the top four. Like, realistically, was that ever sustainable? Of course, there are examples of teams that have pulled it off, like Leicester being the very obvious, but there's a reason that things like that don't happen very often. And so I think the second half of the season was bad, and you can't escape the fact that that was probably an underperformance. But then, like on balance of that first half of the season, I think they were probably playing above themselves to have a new manager, so many new players, just instantly turn things around. But unquestionably, like that point where we knew there was a fairly extended period of time, wasn't there, where we knew that Sven was going to be going, and that, you know, the supporters didn't want him to go, and there was the whole sort of save our Sven stuff. I think that indicates some of the sort of internal turmoil and that things weren't necessarily being very well run. I think there's loads of factors as to why the second half wasn't as good. But I think you do have to set it in context that the first half was just so much better than we could reasonably have expected it to be anyway.
Yeah. Chris, when you're thinking it, like it all culminates in that 8-1 loss at Middlesbrough, and like it feels an awful shame that is Sven's last game in charge, and that's kind of how his legacy is viewed by people outside the club, in that it just all turned to this horrific performance in Middlesbrough. What do you put that down to? Because there's a lot of talk of players, you know, protesting in that game, and I've asked players that were involved, and you know, I've never been able to get to the bottom of whether it was or it wasn't. It just feels like that game was such a I mean, such a bad moment for everybody.
Well, I've been berated by a couple of smoggies over the years about that. They seem to hold it dear to their hearts that they managed to beat City 8-1. I mean, we had beaten them, what was it, 3-1 at home that season and 2-0 away the previous season. It was a complete freak result. Unfortunately for Middlesbrough, we were well aware, even if they weren't, that our season was already over that day, so it doesn't actually count. Which is a shame for them, but you
awful
know,
shame. Yeah,
I don't make the rules. That's just how it is. But I don't think it was a protest. I think it's as you just said there, and as I've said, everybody knew the season was kind of done. And what's the point in busting your balls on Teesside for a manager that you know isn't going to be there next season? You don't know if you're going to be there next season. You've got a very nice holiday booked, thank you very much, and you don't want to get injured. Let's just see this out and get the hell out of Middlesbrough.
And I've spoken to Richard Dunn about it, who's got a very funny yarn on that Hans Backer, Sven's assistant, was did a bit of a team talk beforehand that was basically imploring them not to get silly and get loads of bookings because City were ahead in the Fair Play League, which eventually would get them into Europe. Of course, the punchline of that is that Dunny then went and got himself sent off in the 5th minute, I think. He said he was walking off feeling really bad for all that Hans Backer said was don't get booked, and he's gone and got himself sent off really early on. So yeah, that's a good one. Probably one that he'll recycle in many an after dinner speech.
Richard, just to finish then, how do you reflect on the overall season of Sven at City?
I think the more time goes on, the more I look back at it fondly. I think at the time, I didn't enjoy the end of the season at all. And it probably had ultimately maybe not an overall positive view of it. But the more time goes on and remember just how fun that first half of the season was and how good it was to be United twice. And even having an 8-1 defeat at the end of it, with everything that has sort of come at City since, like even that is, it's hard to praise them for it, but it's not like it's a funny little moment, a funny little footnote in our
Harry City, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. In our Premier League history. And yeah, Sven brought back something that had been missing for so long. He made it fun to watch City again. And ultimately, like, isn't that just what you want your football team to be? You want to go with a little bit of hope that something good might happen, and you want to enjoy it while you're watching. And we had that, and we had good results along with it for a decent portion of the time. So, yeah, I reflect on it very fondly. And it was just good to have something to enjoy again after a period where we had not.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
That was a look back over Sven-Göran Eriksson's time at Manchester City. Everyone here at the Blue Moon Podcast would like to send our best wishes to Sven and his family following that terminal cancer diagnosis. Adam, you were originally going to be part of that discussion, but sadly we couldn't make diaries sync up, so you couldn't be involved with it. I asked you initially because I know that this is one of your favourite seasons.
Yeah, that when we did our lockdown sessions and we were doing season reviews, I instantly hit you up and said I need to do the Sven season, because after the Kevin Keegan season. That's my favourite one. You know, even in comparison to some of the stuff we've witnessed over the recent years, he was just, we hadn't scored a goal at home in 8 months. And then he comes along with all these new fancy players who we got to learn and learn about and enjoy. He obviously oversaw a derby double for the first time in God knows how long in our lifetime. And he oversaw the emergence of Michael Johnson as well, local lad on the world stage, or certainly on the national stage at that point. We went unbeaten at home until Christmas. We were touching the European places in February. So just a all-round special gentleman. And obviously, like you say, we wish him well as he copes with his illness. But just what a legend, what a man. And he really elevated us to that next level. I always echo that sentiment when I talk about Sven.
Yeah. John, have you worked with him? Have you ever interviewed him?
Yeah. Yes, I did. Before I covered England regularly, as I do now, I would step in and interview him occasionally when, you know, I would say on quite a number of occasions spoke to him, and, you know, he's always utterly charming. You know, that is what you would say about him. Certainly, I would like to send my best to him as well if he happens to be tuning into this. But I remember once as well sitting on a plane. We were coming back. I think it was the draw for Euro 2004. We were certainly coming back from Portugal. And we ended up getting upgraded, most unusually, that hardly ever happened to me. Ended up getting upgraded and put in the seat next to Sven-Göran Eriksson. So I remember having a lovely chat with him on the plane on the way back when we actually had a bit of time to talk when sitting on the plane. So that was a real really fond memory, actually.
Yeah.
He was telling, you know, at the time, because we'd coming back from Lisbon, he was talking about his time at Benfica and how much he loved it there, and you know, how the Portuguese people felt about him. And if you remember, when it came to Euro 2004, you know, how close England were. England were probably close to, if not the best team at that tournament. Yeah, and had it not been for the quarterfinal, wasn't it, against Portugal, that was such a fine line, you know, might well have actually won something under Sven-Göran Eriksson.
Yeah, when you think back to his time at City, Adam, it's like, I kind of feel sad that it all petered out into that 8-1 defeat at Middlesbrough for him at City, because it, like, he didn't deserve that, did he? From what he brought earlier in the season, he didn't deserve it to end that way.
Yeah, we've just typical City'd all over him there, haven't we? It was a glorious season. And then obviously there was a few weird results when backroom kind of noise was louder than what we were doing on the pitch. I think that took over and it was allowed to take over in a way that it shouldn't have been. Obviously, he was competing with the off-field stories around our owner and what crazy situation that was. So for him to be the ultimate gentleman, even towards the end when we had like our Save Our Sven campaigns and stuff like that, he was dignified right to the end of his tenure at City. So we'll always be thankful for that as well as City fans, because he gave us our best days and then ironically the biggest loss. And it won't blot his copybook, no way.
Yeah, not in the slightest. We're going to finish this week with a few listener questions. Get in touch on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email us through the website as well. Just go to bluemoonpodcast.com and fill in the form there. Andy on Twitter says, are you worried by how much of the Premier League's case with City is being done in private? Why can't they even tell us the dates so we know when to expect an outcome? This is obviously in relation to Richard Masters, the Premier League's chief executive, speaking to MPs on the Culture, Media and Sport Committee this week. I've got a little clip from what he said, so let's have a listen to what Richard Masters said there.
If any club, whether the current champions or otherwise, had been found in breach of the spending rules for full year 23, they would be in exactly the same position as Everton or Nottingham Forest. But the volume and character of the charges laid before Man City, which I obviously cannot talk about at all, are being heard in a completely different environment. There is a date set for that proceeding. I can't, unfortunately, tell you when that is, but that is progressing.
But can you give us you can't give us the status of the Man City and indeed the Chelsea investigations?
No, I can't give any details on Man City beyond saying that a date has been set. I can't tell you when that date is.
John, is that a bit odd?
I think because it's so complicated and, you know, there are obviously the 115 charges and each one will have to be given all of the due attention that it needs. I think not. But, I mean, I have seen it reported that there may be further developments next week. I'm not sure what, but, you know, we might know a little bit more next week. And, you know, the fact is, I know it's frustrating for Manchester City, part of that frustration being that it is a stick that is being used to beat City, you know, for whatever they do, however successful they are. And it will continue to be until we reach the point where we find out the outcome.
Yeah. Adam, for yourself, when you think about the privacy around it, I'm wondering if actually that's a good thing. Because like if you hear every constant update and detail and detail and detail, I mean, first off, it like you'll be weighed down by it week after week after week. But the second thing is that it doesn't give anybody like outside the club anything to latch onto and like, another thing to have to defend and another thing to have to talk about here. It's kind of like just wait for the decision and we'll get a decision. We don't know when it will be. It will be at some point in the future, but there will be a decision.
Yeah, there's two sides of the coin with the secrecy element of it. Obviously, the benefit of it is that because no little things are being leaked, it doesn't mean that everyone on Twitter or any element of discourse suddenly becomes a finance and legal expert and they know the ins and outs of everything. So it stops that. The privacy thing does... The only thing that privacy can do, even though I think it's the right thing to do, it's perceptually like masks things because of the secrecy of it. Obviously, it's legally the right thing to do. It can't be washed in, you know, in the court of public opinion that way. But it's an automatic conspiracy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, football so tribalism anyway. Any perceived wrongdoings from another club, all the other clubs are able to jump on it. So that's my two kind of pronged look at this. Yes, I'm glad for the privacy because it's the legally correct things to do. I think being in private, it probably just even adds to the air that there's something dodgy going on. But we just need to be ready for the decision. Obviously, the amount of experts that are out there are perceived experts that think they know what they're talking about. When they say, oh, as soon as there's any update in Everton or Forest's cases, it says that the first reply on any discourse is, but what about City? Well, it's completely different charges. It's like comparing a speeding ticket to a parking ticket. You wouldn't get a parking ticket and say, but what about him speeding? They're dealt with completely different things. It's not sustainability issues that City have been charged with. It's a completely different thing. So to be able to just lump it in the same conversation is just tiring. But I can't honestly say I wouldn't be doing the same if it was the other way around. So I'm not going to criticise rival fans too much. And it's because we've been so successful on the perceived back of these charges as well. If it's United and they're throwing loads of money at it and they're rubbish, it's funny. But when we're throwing loads of money at things and become successful of it, it's a problem because of the way we may or may not have obtained it. So I think that adds to the fuel to the fire as well, because we are winning trophies on what Pep's built and what the club have built.
Yeah. John, I've seen a few people suggest this week that the Premier League has a bit of an image problem with this, because obviously City could in theory go on and win the league again this season, and you end up in a situation where they're presenting medals to a team that they are investigating.
Yeah, and I get the criticism as well, or the conversations from Newcastle last week about where they are in all of this, and they feel that they are being severely restricted by the rules as they are at the moment, and that they're not able to challenge in the way that they'd want to, and there's a change coming along the way, isn't there? I think there is going to be an adjustment to how the profit and sustainability rules work, and from what I hear, it's going to be more aligned to the way that UEFA do it, so it'll be based on wages and transfers against revenue rather than this amount you're allowed to lose over a specific period of time. So that change will come, but you know, there's something not right. It's not quite right at the moment because of the way that if you're there, as Manchester City and the other top clubs are, if you are where you want to be, then it's very difficult to challenge that with the rules as they are at the moment. So something does need to change.
Yeah. We will follow it as it develops. I'm expecting the news next week will probably just be the time scale, but we'll kind of see how that goes. We'll cover it on next week's show. We're going to finish this week, though, with Colm on Twitter, who says, very simply, tell us your favourite City games in the snow. John, I'm going to widen this out for you for just any game.
Thanks.
In the snow, because obviously it's already a narrow criteria, but I'll come to you in a second. Adam, favourite City games in the snow?
Yeah, I've got two. There was one away at Arsenal. I think the snow had just cleared, but they'd painted the lines blue. And they scored that wonderful team goal. Everyone was involved.
Actually, going back to the start of the show, That's a wonderful team move, ruined by the fact that Sane scuffs the finish.
Exactly what John said in his description of a beautiful goal. About 30 crisp, precise passes moving, unlike anything we'd ever seen before, and then it just kind of trickles over the line. So that is a perfect example of the best rubbish goal. Yeah. So that Arsenal game, although the snow had kind of subsided, so I'm going to go for a recent game against West Ham where the snow came down. It was at the Etihad. I'm at the stadium. Even I can't see the ball, and I've not got to run around to look for it. I can sit in my nice seat, perched high, and even I can't see the ball. We kept hold of it for what seemed about 20 minutes. You could see the lines in the snow as the ball was travelling between pass to pass. So it was like a real-life heat map, if you will. And then Gundogan just sticks it away at the back post. And just to have the composure to play in those conditions and to still be able to play your normal game and to control the ball in the way they did. So that just sticks in my memory in terms of a snow-based football match.
Yeah, I'm going to throw in two others. Do you remember Fulham at home?
Yes, where they were cleaning the lines at halftime.
In Mancini's title-winning season. What made that one so good is Aguero scored a penalty. And when the ball hit the net, the snow fell off the top of the net into the back of the goal. Love that. And there's some wonderful pictures from City away at West Brom under Pellegrini.
Yes, Boxing Day time.
Boxing Day, And they got 3-0 up and then the snow came. And I was glad they were 3-0 up when the snow came.
Because
it just ruined the ability of either team to play football. But there's some great pictures of that. John, thinking about this, actually, I've realised that we don't see the orange ball anymore. They just use the yellow ball. And I'm not sure that's as good.
No, I agree. And my memory, actually, and I'm pleased you've widened it out for me, because I'm going back into my youth when I remember I went with a friend of mine to Roker Park.
Stood on the
terracing at the Fulwell end and watched Liverpool in the snow. And Liverpool, I think it was probably the first time I'd seen Liverpool, who were so strong at the time. And they were wearing yellow kit with red pinstripes. And Ian Rush scored one of the goals, and I remember seeing him up close for the first time. He was like a whippet, you know, there was nothing on him at all, and such a brilliant goal scorer. And that match played in the snow, and I think I'm right in saying that that was with an orange ball as well.
I miss the orange ball, because like you, Adam, I can't see the yellow one in the snow, so I'm glad of it. Tell us your favourite games in the snow. Get in touch on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. Email us as well. BlueMoonPodcast.com is where you can fill in the form there. But that brings this week's show to a close. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for this one, Adam Carter.
A pleasure.
And John Murray.
Thanks, David.
I'll be back next week to preview that FA Cup trip to Spurs. We might be reminiscing about another FA Cup trip to Spurs. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
Anybody who grew up in the kind of time frame that we did will always have a soft spot for Joe Royle. And the way that he has spoken about City since is always very nice to hear. But I think Mancini, for all sorts of reasons, he was a very different character to anybody we've probably had before. He was a difficult man, but he did bring what he promised.
I'm going to say something that is possibly a bit mad here, but I think that Joe Royle and Roberto Mancini are very similar in what they brought to City.
They were both kind of, I don't want to say brutal, but they both knew what they wanted and needed and always had a way of getting it done.
Yeah.
I'd say that Joe Royle did it in a softer way, both with the players and the fans, whereas Mancini was, I'm going to do this and win at all costs. I will alienate any player I need to. I will do what is needed. Joe Royle is just, I think the way he's aged has been lovely, and it's always nice to hear him because you don't hear him very often. So anything he does say is usually quite nice about that side.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast and join us again next time for another episode.
Hi,
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster is very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.